Okay, so last class before the break. What I think we can do today is to finish up the part that we started yesterday about the how the field has changed upon all the results of the new transcriptomic experiment by RNA-seq, and discuss some of the conclusion that have been drawn by the type of results that we looked at yesterday afternoon. And then we can spend a little bit of time looking at how to assess this type of results on a web browser. We did a little bit of that yesterday, but I thought we can go a little bit more in detail on a different browser today. And then after break, I want to go very briefly do an overview of other transcriptomic techniques that are available, that have been developed in the last few years, that go beyond RNA-seq and that may be useful just to know what they are, because more and more you will find them in papers, and so it's interesting, good to know what all these names stands for. Okay, so to start with some conclusions from the studies done before, I thought I would include this review as a reference textbook material, because it goes through the data that we have analyzed yesterday, and it derives some important conclusion of how the field of transcriptomic has changed since the development of RNA-seq. And so the people that wrote this review are one of the group that has been driving the GeneCode project. So it's their, it's a prospective, I think they call it, they call it perspective paper. So it's not really new result, it's not really a review, it's more their, it's a commentary, it's their opinion about how the RNA-seq data has changed the way in which we look at the concept of RNA expression, the concept of gene, and the type of things that are still out there that needs to be addressed in the future, and how they think that we can address them. So it's more of a, it's not really philosophical, but more, it's more of an interpretation of data rather than a presentation of results. Okay, so the first thing that they look into is the fact that the type of results that have been collected through RNA-seq data has really changed our perception of the complexity of the transcription and the gene expression. And so, oh no, I didn't. Okay, so the first thing that they discuss is the idea of what is a gene and how the idea of what is a gene has changed in the last 10 years because of the RNA-seq results. Mostly the result, they discuss it from the point of view of the ENCODE project, so mostly the result that have come out of the ENCODE project as we discussed it yesterday. And so they go through the description of what is the idea of a gene, and they and so they start from what people thought of a gene initially. So the initial idea was that a gene was something that was the genomic information linked to a trait that could be inherited. And so was a phenotype something like the color of the eye or the a certain phenotype during development that was linked to a specific location in the genome, and that was considered a gene. That's coming from the very initial studies in genetics where in different organisms, different areas were mutated and then linked to a functional effect, a phenotype in Drosophila or in worm or other organism. Then as we went further and we started to know more about the DNA, it moves to what is called the central dogma of molecular biology, proposed after in the 70s, which is the one that we discussed on Monday at the beginning of this section. So the idea that the flow of information goes from DNA to RNA to protein, and so there is a direct correlation between the site on the genome where the DNA information is located to the final product that is a protein in itself. And so the RNA in this view was considered like a vehicle, didn't have anything to do, didn't have any specific function on itself. It was the way to transfer the genetic information from the DNA to the final product that is the protein. And because of this linear relationship, the gene was the genomic region where the RNA was, the information for the RNA was encoded, and therefore the information for the protein was encoded. Now, as we discussed when we went through the data yesterday, the situation is much more complicated, right? Because first of all, from one single gene locus, you can have multiple transcripts, not one single mRNA, but multiple ones because of RNA splicing. And so this complicates the situation when you talk about gene expression, as we discussed, because you may be having certain transcripts that are highly expressed and others that are not expressed or low expressed. So you have to start considering the idea that there are many transcripts within the same gene locus. The second thing is that there are non-coding region. So non-coding region obviously don't lead to a final product that is a protein, but there are still RNA, there is still RNA produced. And so this challenged the whole idea that the whole function of the RNA is to serve as an intermediate between the DNA and the protein, because there is clearly a large area of the genome that is transcribed. It gives rise to transcripts, and those transcripts are often functional. It's unclear whether they are always functional or not, but they are often functional. And they are functional despite the fact that they don't lead to any proteins, okay? So that's another layer of complexity. Further layer of complexity is that there are also cases where you have what they call the read-through transcription. I briefly touched upon that yesterday when I showed you one example on the browser. So those are cases where you start transcribing a gene and then it splices into a gene that is next door to it. And this sometimes gives rise to mRNA that is non-productive and get degraded, but in some cases it is a productive RNA. It can be a coding or a non-coding RNA, but it's productive. And so these also further challenge the idea of a gene, because now you have two loci that were considered two separate genes, but you have, and each of them has their own transcript, but then you also have transcript that overlaps the two loci. And so in theory, it's one transcript out of two genes. And so how do you connect the idea of what is a gene with the fact that then you have a transcript that overlaps two genes and then may lead to a protein product that doesn't correspond to any of those two genes, okay? So all of this together, they call it transcriptional complexity. So, and they don't reach any conclusion about how we should call genes, whether we should still call them genes or, and there is a debate in the literature. There are people that say that we should talk about transcribed regions rather than genes, people that are still pushing the nomenclature. And clearly this is a nomenclature that now has entered into the life of everyone, not only the people who study biology, but also common people who read the news article in the newspapers. So I don't think we will abandon the concept of gene anytime soon. But as biologists, when we read about genes, we should keep in mind the fact that the concept of what a gene is has evolved, and it doesn't really correspond anymore to this relationship one-to-one from from a gene to a protein. There are several layers of complexity added in between. The other thing that they mentioned that it's an important thing to remember, and we already discussed it yesterday, is the idea that the genome is pervasively transcribed. And so this now seems something that is very clear, but it wasn't just a few years ago. So we're not talking about 50 years ago, but just at the beginning of 2010, it wasn't that clear that the genome was fully transcribed. The idea was that the coding region in the genome were very limited. There was a small percentage that was transcribed. And then the rest of it wasn't unclear whether it was functional or not. Because of these papers, because of this work done through the ENCODE project, it's now clear that about more than 70% of the genome is transcribed. The question is how much of it is functional, and we'll discuss a little bit more about that. Okay, so this is the overall topic of this review. And this is how they discuss this idea of how the concept of a gene has changed. So this is exactly what we just discussed, nothing new. We can split this in two so that it's easier to see. This is the old view of what a gene is, the central dogma. So you have a gene, an area in the genome that is transcribed, then the transcript is processed to eliminate the introns, and then the processed mRNA has added a cap, and the poly A is translated into a polypeptide. So that was the view prior to all this transcriptomic result. What they discuss is the fact that now things have changed, and they've changed based on everything we just said. So the fact that there are other layers of complexity, and so this is the gene as you, this is the same loci than before, so they're discussing the same one. And they say from this same gene you can get a lot of different things. You can get the product that before we were considering, the one with the splicing that include all the introns, and then it gets polyadenylated, capped, and translated. So there is the final product that we were thinking of before. However, there are a lot of other things that before were unknown. There is the possibility of alternative splicing, so other transcript that maybe miss an exon because of exon skipping. As we saw yesterday, exon skipping is the most common alternative splicing event that can happen. And if you think about alternative splicing in terms of final product, because with the concept of gene, each gene leads to a product, these are not only two alternative splicing forms in terms of RNA, but they lead to two different peptides, right? Because the fact that there is an exon missing here, it means that it leads to a translated protein that has a missing portion, that could be a missing domain, and it could change completely the function of the protein. So if this, for example, is a catalytic enzyme, a catalytic domain of an enzyme, it's a kinase, and this is the catalytic domain, these two alternative forms can be completely different because one leads to an active kinase, the other one leads to an enzyme that doesn't have the catalytic domain and is maybe a dominant negative form. So these already challenged the original view, because instead of having one peptide, one protein coming out of that gene, you have two proteins, possibly with completely different functions. Another possibility is that there is an intron that gets retained, still alternative splicing, and the retained intron can, again, change the type of polypeptide that you get out of it, but it could also lead to a non-coding RNA. And that's why they put it in red, because it is possible that by adding another intron there, you change the frame of the sequence, and therefore, instead of ending up with a transcript that is translated into a protein, you end up with a transcript that is non-coding and may have different function. Then there is the possibility of antisense transcription. This was also something that was not well appreciated before the studies that we have looked into. However, it's now clear that there is a large number of antisense non-coding RNA that are transcribed in the genome. We looked yesterday at some of the numbers of how many non-coding RNA have been identified. And these are new forms that are still transcribed from the same locus and that may change the outcome in terms of changing the proteins that are produced out of that locus. And then finally, there is the possibility of transcription, of read-through transcription, as we discussed, where the transcript of this particular gene just keep going instead of stopping and keeps going and splicing to the gene that is next to it. And this, in this case, leads to a much longer transcript. Now, this can be a, there are two different options. One is that it leads to a functional transcript. The other possibility, more often, is that it leads to a non-functional transcript. And that's the example that they show here. PTC is the, it's an early termination codon. I think they call it a premature termination codon. And so, and this simply means that by splicing in this different way, it adds, the sequence is such that when it reaches that point, there is a termination codon in the sequence. Now, in the cell, there is something that is called nonsense-mediated decay of RNA. I don't know if you looked at it in past classes. No. So it's a way for the cell to, it's a process through which the cell degrade certain messenger RNA. It's considered a way to degrade mRNA that are not functional. So whenever there is a mistake in the transcription and you produce an mRNA that is not functional, the cell can degrade it and get rid of it through a complex of protein that is that mediate what is called nonsense. I think it's written here. Yes, nonsense mediated decay, degradation pathway. So it's a few proteins that will recognize this mRNA and send it to degradation so that you don't spend energy transcribing something that is incorrect. One of the reasons why mRNA are recognized by the nonsense mediated decay pathway is the fact that there is a premature termination codon. So often, run through transcripts are degraded, but it's also possible that there is not the premature termination codon, that the sequence is such that the transcript can just continue in frame, and then if it continues in frame, it's possible that it leads to the production of a functional protein. And so this is another case, as we said before, where instead of getting one protein from each gene, you get one common protein from two genes, and so that add to the layer of complexity. Okay, so just as an example, because until now we have been talking about theoretical cases, I thought I would include an example of a real loci where there are examples of all this complexity mixed together. So this is a case that people have been studying for a very long time, and one of the reasons why it has been so complicated to study the expression of these genes is because they present all kind of alternative splicing and weird combination of what we have been looking at before. So this is the human P16 locus. So it's located on chromosome 9. And it's the locus that include the INC4A or INC4B and INC4A proteins, genes, sorry. So these are inhibitors of CDK proteins. So they inhibit, you may also know them as P15 and P16. They are cell cycle regulators, tumor suppressor. They regulate the binding of CDK4 and CDK6 to their cyclin counterparts. So their expression is extremely important because they regulate cell cycle and therefore are involved in a number of processes They may be misregulated in cancer and other diseases. And one of the things that people found long time ago was that this locus is associated with the predisposition for a number of diseases, not only cancer, but also cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity. And this was done by identifying SNPs that are variation in the sequences that are present in this locus that are associated with increased disease predisposition. However, so the follow-up studies were trying to understand how these different SNPs, this variation in the sequence, could be mechanistically linked to the disease progression. And this was complicated by the fact that some of the SNPs fell into coding sequences, but other SNPs fell into regions where there didn't look like there was any transcription going on. So there was the idea that maybe some were regulatory region, and so people studied this locus for a long time. The result of all these studies combined with new approaches lead to the description of a very complicated locus. So the first thing that you can see here is that there are two genes. One is in blue and one is in yellow. However, the product that comes, that is produced, the protein that comes out of these two genes is actually three different proteins. So there is one gene that is the INC4B, or I think this is CDK inhibitor, CDK2A inhibitor, is the CDK inhibitor 2B and CDK inhibitor 2A. So instead of INC4, it's CDK inhibitor 2, and then it's A or B. So this gene here encodes for a very small protein, two exons that are spliced regularly. You get one protein out of it that is called P15. This locus here is different because instead of having one single protein out of it, you can get two different proteins. You can get P14 and P16. P14 is also called ARF, whereas P16 is called INC4A or CDK2 inhibitor A. The difference between these two is that there is alternative splicing. So the first possibility is that this first exon here splice into exon 2 and then exon, and then the protein is finished, right? And then it splices into exon 3 here and it's finished. The other possibility is that it uses a different exon 1 that splices into exon 2 and then in exon 3, and that leads to the production of P16. So these are two alternatives. So the type of splicing that is produced here is what yesterday we described as alternative start site, because these are two alternative exon 1. So it's not that the transcription is always started in the same point and then you splice out a different exon. These are situations in which you have two different start sites with two different promoters. So this is one start site, this is another start site. Each one has its own promoter, and then each one leads to the transcription of a different first exon. And then the first exon from here splices into exon 2, and that's the P14. This exon instead splices into exon 2 and then exon 3, and that is P16. Okay? So this is a clear example of something where from one locus, one gene locus, you get two different protein products. The next DOR gene give only one protein product. However, there is also extensive transcription in the opposite direction. And this is shown here. So there is a promoter that is directed into the opposite direction. It starts with this exon here, and then it continues with its very, very long transcript. And this is a non-coding RNA. So this is a case of antisense transcription of a non-coding RNA. This is a very famous non-coding RNA that is called ANRIL, as shown here. So this is a case where a coding protein gene is encoded within the sequence of a non-coding RNA, okay? The interesting thing is that most of the SNPs that are disease-associated don't fall into the coding sequences, but fall into the sequences of the unreal gene. So these things, these arrows in blue, are the location of the most famous SNPs that are disease-associated. And so that tells you that mutations into these locus, the locus that derive the non-coding RNA, lead to changes in gene expression of these genes, and that's what drives the predisposition to the disease. Okay, anything else to say about this? No, I think, is that clear? Yeah. It's an example, okay? But it's just an example to show on one single locus how all this complexity together can really make it difficult to understand the biology behind it. Because you don't have one gene giving you one protein, so that if you find a mutation in the gene, you know exactly what's going wrong. It's a situation where there is a lot more going on. Yes?
The transcription of the allele is on the other strand.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the other direction. So the transcription of allele starts here, and it goes in this direction, so it's on this strand.
Okay.
The transcription of INC4AB starts within one of the introns of a allele and goes in the opposite direction. So one thing to say is that it's still unclear how a lot of this works. Some of the latest papers have shown that this non-coding RNA can interact with the chromatin remodeling proteins of the PRC complex, and these lead to inhibition of these genes. So it's a non-coding RNA that is encoded within the locus lead to the repression of the genes that are encoded in the same locus. However, there are a lot of things that are not clear, including the fact that these three genes are often not regulated together. So there must be additional layer of complexity that are still not understood. I went to a seminar just a couple of weeks ago where they were studying the role of this locus in type 2 diabetes, and they were finding that these two, I think it was the P15 and P16, they were co-regulated, whereas P14 was regulated in the opposite direction. One was associated with the disease, the other one was not. So it's not as simple as this RNA inhibits everything else. The other thing is that this is shown as one transcript, but there is actually not only one transcript. As you can see, there are a lot of exons in RNA, and what people are starting to find is that there are a lot of different transcripts coming out of this non-coding RNA that can be longer or shorter. So there can be non-coding RNA that encompass the whole sequence, as well as non-coding RNA that are shorter. And depending probably on their length, they're going to have different functions. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to do with this was, now that I showed you how complex this locus is, I wanted to show you how you can look at this kind of information on the web browser, just to give you an example. Okay, so... And to do that, I thought I would use the WashU epigenome browser just to give you an example. As I said, as we discussed yesterday, there are a lot of different browsers you can use. The one I showed you yesterday was the UCSC that web browser. So UCSC is the University of California, Santa Cruz. This is WashU, which is the University of Washington in St. Louis. So they're just many universities who have a large genomic component have come up with their own browser. One of the reasons why I think this is an interesting browser to look at is because it allows you to access to a lot of data. There is a lot of public data that has already been uploaded on this browser, and you can just look at it and browse through it. And so it can be useful when we start looking at gene expression analysis next week, just to know how you can look at those kind of data. Okay? So let's see if I can show you. I have included, if you are interested in this kind of things and you want to play with it, I have included in the folder where I put the extra material a booklet with information of how to navigate through the browser. It's a really easy and simple to follow booklet that has been produced this year. Just a few months ago, there was one of the big genomic meeting in the U.S. It's at Keystone, and the people that have come up with the epigenome have developed the epigenome browser. They have done a workshop at the meeting, and this is the information material that they gave at the workshop. So it really allows you to go step by step and show you figure by figure what you have to click. So if you are interested, that's an interesting thing to look at. Okay, so this is what the browser look like. So this is the first page when you just click on it, and it just shows you, this is just a picture, but it just shows you that you can access a lot of information through this browser. So you can really look at the track of the experiments, you can look at the gene annotation, and then we'll look at this next week, but it also allows you to look at how different areas of the genome are connected together when there is folding of the chromosome and those kind of things. So that's why I think it's a useful tool. And then if you click on the genome browser, so this here, you see it's workshop Keystone 2018. It's what I was telling you. They have done this workshop, and here they have put the material. It's the same PDF files that I have included in your folders. If you click here on the epigenome browser, you come to a place where you can choose which kind of species you want to work with. So let's start with human. Hopefully it works. Yes. Okay. Then he asks you what you would like to work with, and we'll start with genome browser. If you have your own sequences and you want to upload, you can go to custom and upload your sequence and work with them. Okay. So then it brings you to a page like this where you can navigate to the gene you are interested in. So if we go here, we can write either the coordinates or the gene name. So in our case, we do CDK inhibitor, and then we go to the 2A. And then it gives you a lot of possibilities. You can just choose one reference gene, and then we play with the other later. Okay, and so here, it comes up with the sequence of the CDK and 2A gene. You can just make it a little smaller so that you can look at the entire locus. Okay, so here you can see you have the CDK and 2A and the CDK and 2B gene. And you see, if you look at it on a genome browser, it's much more complicated than to look at it on the drawings where people have already put together all this information. But the type of sequences that you are looking at are the one that that allowed people to design that kind of drawings, right? So, okay, so I think this is a good size. Okay, so CDK and 2B is the gene. So think about the fact, it's reversed compared to what we were looking at before, right? So the CDK and 2B is the one that is included in the end of the unreal. So this long thing here is the transcript, all the transcript that have been reported for unreal, and that's why they call it CDK and 2B anti-strand. Okay, the real coding protein is just this little thing here, CDK and 2B that is transcribed in the opposite direction. There were only two exons, if you remember. There were no different alternative splicing forms. So there is only one transcript for CDK and 2B. Whereas for the non-coding antisense, there are a lot of different transcripts. And that's what I was saying at the end. It looks like there is not only one single non-coding RNA transcribed here, but there are many different forms. Some include all the different exons, some are much shorter, or include only some exon, but for example, all these forms don't have this exon here in between. And so it's going to be a challenge for the scientists who are working on these molecules to understand what each of these transcripts means. This one here, CDKN2A, is the locus that leads to the two protein products. And so you have the shorter one, which is exon 1, 2, and 3, that is that give rise to the P16. And then the longer one that start almost at the end of the antisense in the opposite direction is the one that encodes for the P14, right, the ARF protein. And so this is the type of data that can support the studies that we were discussing before. Now, the other thing I wanted to show you was that if you look at this this way, the first thing that comes out are the RefSeq genes. So if you remember yesterday, we discussed about the fact that there are different project that are trying to use the transcriptomic data to combine them into what they call gene models, so that they give, they associate all the transcript to specific gene loci. And so RefSeq was one of those, and that's the representation that you are looking at. However, if you go here on tracks, you can look at a lot of other type of tracks. And so if you look at the annotation and genes, you see that right now it's showing you the RefSeq genes, but you can also use it, look at the gene code. And there are even different annotation of the gene code genes. It now reports the last two ones that have been published. And so if you click on the V19, for example, it shows you all the transcripts that have been collected through the gene code project and that are part of the gene code model. And here, you can see the same thing we were looking at before. It's a little bit easier to see because they color code things. So green stuff are non-coding. And so this is the one you're looking at here. The long one is the non-coding, the RL non-coding RNA. Whereas in blue, they show here the coding information. So that's the short gene that is in the opposite direction of RL, as well as CDK and 2A, the two products, the long one and the short one. The other thing is that if you click on each of them, if you just click on each of them, then you get a lot of information about that specific transcript. So if you are studying a certain protein, you want to know how many transcripts there are, you can just click here. It shows you that this is transcript number 9. And then if you look down, it shows you the gene biotype and the transcript biotype. And so these we'll discuss a little bit more, but out of all the studies that have been done, RNAs have been collecting in different types. Transcript can be classified based on biotypes. And so whether they are coding, non-coding, long, short, and so here it tells you this kind of information. So here it tells you that it's an antisense type of transcript. And if you click on transcript ID, then it shows you a page where you can look at all the transcript. And so here it reports all the transcripts that are associated with the RL non-coding RNA with information about whether they are sense, antisense, coding, non-coding. Okay? So if you do the same thing for this thing that is, here. Okay. So you see that here in between, so here is the CDKN2A. Here is the CDK N2B with Unreal, the long one. If you look in the gene code, there is also a transcript that seems to be a run-through transcript. So what we discussed before, right? A situation where transcription from this gene, this is a separate gene, it's the gene that is called the MTAP, seem to be a transcript that goes over MTAP and come all the way into the locus of the CDKN2A and CDKN2B. And so one thing you may wonder is whether this is also functional transcript that on top of everything else is regulating this locus. But then if you click on this one, then what you see is a table like the one I showed you before. It tells you that it seems to be a coding region because it has a open reading frame that comes from the previous gene. However, if you look down here, where you look at the transcript biotype, it tells you that it's a nonsense mediated decay. So exactly what we discussed before, this is an example of run-through transcription that leads to a non-functional mRNA that is recognized by the degradation complex, the nonsense mediated degradation complex, and therefore probably degraded and probably doesn't give rise to any actual proteins. Okay, so the other thing is that if you do the same thing, but instead of looking at the human, you look at the mouse. So sometimes one thing that we haven't discussed at all, but that is done a lot in the transcriptomic field, is to do comparative analysis between different genomes. And the idea is that products that are highly functional are conserved among different species. And so one way also to look into how all the transcripts that are annotated are functional or not is to look at whether they are conserved or not. Obviously, there are two cases. One is that they are so important that they are conserved across all species. The other is that they are important for a function that is specific only to a certain species and not to another. And so there may be highly functional but be specific to a certain species. But comparative transcriptomics is usually done to look at conservation. And so if you do the same thing for the mouse and you look at the CDKN2G here, CDKN2A in the mouse genome, you see that it's a much more simple loci. So doesn't matter how small you go, there is nothing else. So here is MTAP, so the gene that was next door, from which there was that run-through transcription. Here is CDKN2A, the long form and the short form, so P14 and P16. And this is CDKN2B, so P15. Doesn't look like there is any non-coding RNA. So Unreal seemed to be a specific, human-specific non-coding RNA. As I said, there are cases where the fact that something is not conserved suggests that it's not functional. This case, there is enough data in human that suggests that it is a functional non-coding RNA. So this is a case where this seems to be something that is human-specific. However, it makes very difficult to study this locus because you cannot use mouse to model any of this. So you can delete CDK2A or CDK2B in mice, but you cannot modulate the non-coding RNA because it's not there. And so this has been a limiting factor for studying the function of this locus. Okay, so quickly, just these are the same thing we've already discussed. So this is the on the same paper, they discuss the fact that there are several type of transcripts that have been identified, and we can classify them based on the RNA biotype. And so the type of transcript that have been identified can be protein coding, can be long non-coding RNA, antisense long-coding RNA, intergenic non-coding RNA. So these are all non-coding RNA. Same class. The only separate them based on location. So the one that are antisense are called antisense. The one that are found within introns of other genes are called intronic non-coding RNA. The one that are found in the middle of nowhere and between other genes are called non-coding intergenic RNA. But they're all part of the long non-coding RNA. Then there are small non-coding RNA, as well as pseudogenes that come from duplication events or reinsertion in the genome. And so what they show you in the paper is that there are different classes, and these are just lists. You can look at them by yourself. I think we've already discussed all of them. Non-coding, they can be long-coding can be sense, antisense. There is the possibility of an answer RNA that we'll discuss when we look at an answer. Circular RNA, which it's a new form of RNA that has been discovered not many years ago, where the RNA circularizes and function of that are not particularly clear. One things just to mention is how are things classified as non-coding, right? So obviously non-coding means that it doesn't code for a protein, but how do you go about giving this classification as non-coding when you are annotating transcript? And so it's a process that includes a number of evaluation. The most obvious things is that you look for an open reading frame. If there is an open reading frame, it can give rise to a protein. If there is no open reading frame, it's unlikely, unless there has been a mistake in the sequencing, it's unlikely that it can lead to a protein product. But that is usually combined with other type of analysis. The first thing is proteomic database interrogation to look at whether there are proteins that correspond to that possible sequence. And then most importantly now, there are a lot of labs that have started to look at ribosomal associated RNA, and so they have performed ribosomal purification and sequence RNA from associated from ribosomes, because obviously if something is translated at some point it should be found on the ribosomes. If something is non-translated, it should not be found on the ribosomes, right? And so that's also included in this evaluation of how do you decide whether a transcript is coding or non-coding. The other things that have been annotated are small non-coding RNA. And so this is from your research paper that we discussed yesterday. I said we are not going to go through all the classes of short RNA. Just to mention the fact that again, one more time, here they discuss them separately, long and short. And this definition of long and short is based on that 200 base pair separation that is a technical separation. And then within the short ones, what they do is that they tell you a little bit about all the small RNAs that belong to things that have already been annotated before. And so they describe mainly four major classes: the small nuclear RNAs, the small nucleolar RNAs, the microRNA, and the transfer RNAs. And they say that the majority of what they found fall in one of those categories. So these are other type of RNA biotypes. There are some short RNAs that they find that were not that had not been annotated before. And those fall in two different categories. One is almost 90% of them are observed only in one cell line, and they are very low copy numbers. So this seems to be things that are cell type specific. Out of these, about 40% are associated with transcription. They are found present on promoter, on transcriptional star site, on termination star site, on termination sites. And so, and the big question is what they are doing. And To be honest, I don't think anyone has a real handle on this. There are different hypotheses out there. Some people think that some of these, there is some evidence that some of these short RNAs are actually helping the assembly of the transcriptional machinery. So they may be reinforcing protein-protein interaction on the promoter and helping transcription. But there are other people who have different views. So I think this is a new field, that it's really still in the active investigation. We don't have clear conclusion about what these RNA are doing. However, in terms of classification, it's important to know that in addition to these short RNA that are pretty well described, that include the nuclear RNA, the small interfering RNA, the microRNA, the small nuclear RNA, there are also other things that are very small and that are short, that are very small and they're very unstable, which are often classified with these names. So sometimes they're called PARs if they're promoter-associated long RNAs, promoter-associated short RNAs, termini associated short RNAs, and they're basically described based on the location where they are found annotated, not as much on the function, because as I said, there is not much known about their function. So they are described based on where they fall in the genome. Okay, and these just give you a table of what are all these different classes and how many of them are present. This is based on the GeneCode website, one of the latest version, V25 for human and VM11 for mouse. And this shows you the same thing we have been discussed. So the fact that there are long non-coding RNA genes, there are long non-coding RNA transcript, and as you can see, there are more transcript than genes, as you would expect, because you can have splicing also from non-coding region, as we have seen for the RL gene. You have small RNAs of the different classes, in different numbers, as well as here you have number of genes and number of transcript. You have a huge number of transcript compared to the number of genes, if you see, and that corresponds to everything we have discussed in terms of transcriptional complexity. So the last thing that they discuss in this review is, what does this mean, right? We have gone through all this process, we have described thousands and thousands of transcripts, star site, we have reached this understanding, better understanding of transcriptional complexity. Is this all? Are we done, or there is still more to be done? And it's a difficult question, because obviously I think some of the studies we have looked at clearly indicate the fact that depending which species you are looking at, which stage of development you are looking at, which tissue you are looking at, you find different transcriptome. So in theory, it's like trying to define what is the. It's not really infinite, because there is a limit to it. But it's a really large population. You could even argue that you need to do sequencing of each single cell type to be able to really understand the transcriptome of each of the different tissue, the different cell types. And obviously, that's probably not feasible. You could argue that you need to do you need to measure transcriptomes of every single developmental stage, because we saw yesterday with Drosophila that by looking at the different stages and male versus female, they could identify different transcripts. So probably that's not the end in terms of annotation, even though we have reached a large complexity. So what they say is that while there may not be a single human transcriptome, what we need to do is to work with a consensus, right? And so that's what all these projects are trying to do. They are trying to combine the data from different systems into models where you know what are all the transcripts that can be produced. It doesn't tell you that they are all produced at the same time in every developmental stage or every cell type, but it tells you what they are. It's possible that there are some that have not been annotated yet. And so one of the things that they discuss is that in order to move forward and further complete this whole list, probably the only way to do it is to combine, to integrate different data sets, because what has been sequenced is already been sequenced. You can sequence more cell types, but there is a limit to how much of that. Sorry, I forgot to do this. So they say that one way to get a better appreciation of all these different types of transcript is to integrate different data sets. And so they give you one example where they say in order to identify this new long coding RNA, this was not done through sequencing alone or to other approaches alone, but it was possible to identify this long coding RNA only because of combining different data sets. And so what they are talking about was the fact that even from the time of cDNA sequencing and EST sequencing, there had been some sequences that were deposited in this locus. This was not a locus that was associated with any known gene or any known coding region. So those things were just there, deposited, but no one knew what this transcript corresponded to. And then by combining these old data with CAGE and poly-A sequencing data that showed that there were a cluster of transcriptional star site around here and cluster of poly-A around here, they started to consider the possibility that this was something that was transcribed with the beginning and at the end, so potentially a new transcript. And then they combined that with RNA-seq data, and they look at RNA-seq data from a number of tissue. I think they looked at 15 or 20 tissue, and they found that there was some expression of transcript from this area only in two of those samples, in prostate and ovary. And so that allowed them to define this particular transcript as a non-coding RNA that is specifically expressed in some tissue, in this case, the reproductive system. And so that's the example that they give you to show that even from existing data set, it's possible that further mining in terms of combining all the different data sets together can allow us to better define some areas that have not been described yet. And that's exactly what the different gene code RefSeq projects are trying to do. They're combining or integrating all these data sets together in order to build models of what are the transcripts that are present out there. And then the last thing is the big question that remains open. So I think there is one thing to remember from all this, which is that the big question is still not answered. The big question is, what is a functional transcript? How much of the genome is functional? And this we still don't know. So if you think about it, what we have, the type of knowledge we have achieved is the fact that the genome is widely transcribed. But the question of whether what is the function of all these transcripts is still out there. And how you define something that is functional. So it is easy to say that a protein coding transcript is functional because there is a product that you can measure. So a protein coding transcript gives rise to a protein. There is a product, so it's functional, easy. All the non-coding transcripts, those are the difficult ones to define, right? So there are some cases where functionality can be measured in terms of the presence of a specific non-coding RNA regulates the expression of a coding region. And so indirectly, you have an effect on a protein. And so that's also an easier case where we can measure functionality. So that's the example of the unreal RNA before. It has been shown that if you have RL, RL inhibit the expression of CDK2 genes. So it's easy to understand that that is a functional RNA because it has a function, it has an effect on a coding transcript. However, there are a lot of other cases where it's unclear whether non-coding RNAs are functional or not. And one example is the nonsense mediated decay, because It has been described, as I told you, as a way to get rid of transcripts that are that have been mistranscribed or that are non-functional. However, there are evidence, people are starting to study whether the nonsense-mediated decay could actually be a way to regulate gene expression. And so it could be a choice that is made by the cell, so it's not a random event that you get an aberrant RNA and that gets degraded, but could be a specific choice that the cell makes when it wants to downregulate expression, so that you are normally transcribing a certain gene, and this gene is functional, it leads to a protein product. Sometimes you go into a different and alternative splicing or a run-through transcription where you end up with a messenger RNA that is recognized by the non-specific, by the nonsense-mediated decay machinery, and so it gets degraded. This could be something that happens to get rid of non-specific RNA, but it could also be a way that it's used to downregulate the expression of that gene, so that if the cell wants to downregulate the expression of that protein, instead of stopping transcription altogether, it just sends some of the transcription into a direction that is not functional, so it gets degraded, but the transcription is still going, and so the protein can still be produced when necessary. And so some people are starting to look into this, and this is something that we'll see in the next 10 years or so, how much of this is functional or not. But these are examples of something that we would define as non-functional. This is something we would define as the clear example of a junk RNA that is produced by mistake and it's degraded, whereas maybe it's not completely junk. It's produced so that it gets degraded, but the degradation itself has a function because it can be used to downregulate gene expression. And so I think this is the big question that is still out there, very much open. And after the break, we'll look at a few more techniques that can be used to answer this question. Okay, so this last chapter is it's basically an overview of a few more approaches that can be used to study transcriptomics, so things that are next-generation sequencing-based and have been developed in the last few years. They are still in the process of being developed to address the same type of question, but to address some specific aspect of it. And so we'll look at a couple of variations of RNA-seq itself, and then look at some alternative NGS approaches. So first of all, variation of RNA-seq, there are two main things that we should discuss. One is direct RNA sequencing, and the other is single-cell RNA sequencing. So direct RNA sequencing, it's something that we mentioned at the beginning when we discussed how you measure transcript in a cell. We said that basically all the existing methods are based on indirect measurement, right? Because you, if you think about everything we have done until now, you always start with the RNA that you have extracted from the cells, and then you transform that into a cDNA before you go further with the analysis, whether it was Sanger sequencing or deep sequencing. You always first transform the RNA into cDNA by RT, and then you study the cDNA. So it's always an indirect way of measuring RNA. There are a couple of companies and groups that have been trying to set up ways to sequence the RNA directly from cells, from tissue. And this is the first paper that is published. So until last year, there were some development of the sequencing approaches, but no study had been yet published. This is the first study that is published just last month in Nature Methods, and this is based on nanopore technologies, where they show that by using nanopore sequencing, they can directly sequence RNA in a real-time single molecule method that has several advantages, because it first doesn't require an RT step, so you don't risk to include any bias by doing the RT bias during the generation of the cDNA library. Second advantage is that it doesn't need to go through an amplification step, so it, from a quantitative standpoint, you don't risk to insert any error by amplifying in a non-linear way. It also, it's a sequencing method that doesn't require, it's not based on synthesis. So this is something we have not looked at, but as I included some of the material, and we discussed the fact that there are different sequencing platforms that can be used for RNA-seq. They are slightly different, but they all rely on a synthesis step where the molecule is synthesized and is, the sequence is achieved during the synthesis process. This is a different case where they sequence the RNA as it goes through a nanopore. So I couldn't find a good model to show you how it works. It's just been published, so there is not much out there. However, the way in which it works is that there is a membrane that is a polymer membrane with little tiny nanopores across it. And the RNA molecules are pushed against this membrane by a current. And as the current pushed the RNA against this membrane, the RNA, single molecule of RNA, will insert into each different nanopores and go through it. If I understood correctly, there are also some protein machine that are used to slowly help the process of the RNA going through the, like the motor proteins that help the RNA go through the nanopore. And what happens is that the current across the nanopore is measured. So what the machine measures is variation in the current across the nanopore. And then there are algorithms that allow them to transfer the information of a current change into a sequence. Because based on the bases that are going through the nanopore, there is different changes in current, and therefore the changes in current can be translated into sequence information. And what they do is that they add adapters at the beginning, so that the machine first recognizes the adapter and then immediately start reading with the first base after the adapter. And so this allows single base resolution and sequencing of the RNA molecule as it is, without any modification, without amplification, without cDNA, without anything. So for now it's one publication, and I'm not sure how expensive and how scalable these type of experiments are. But one interesting thing that they present is that they have tried to do some correlation analysis of how sequencing of their RNA samples correlate with previous studies done with normal RNA-seq. And so what they compared is that they run either their RNA-seq or two other samples. One is that they did a normal RNA-seq, so with a cDNA step, but they run it through their own machine. So they read the DNA in the same way in which they are reading the RNA now. Or they did a regular Illumina paired RNA-seq. And then they compare the result, and they say that the nanopore, that there is a good agreement between all these approaches, and the direct RNA or the cDNA sequencing on the nanopore machine gives the highest correlation. But there is also good correlation between the direct RNA sequencing and the Illumina RNA-seq. So, and they've done a number of different replicates, and this correlate very well. So this is a proof that the system seems to be working. We'll see how much this will be picked up in the future and whether we'll move to do RNA-seq direct RNA-seq all the time, or whether the older methods are more reliable. Okay, the other modification of RNA-seq that we should discuss is single-cell RNA-seq. We saw yesterday that there are cases where RNA-seq results lead to wonder whether single cells transcriptome differ and whether we should analyze things at a single cell basis. And this is something that people have tried to do for a few years now. The first paper was actually published shortly after the beginning of next generation sequencing. The first paper by Tang et al. Was published, I think, in Nature in 2009. But for a while, there was not much use of single cell seq, mostly because it was crazy expensive. And so not many labs could afford to do single cell seq. It has really picked up in the last few years, since 2012, 2013. So the last couple of years is when people have really started to do single cell seq on a more regular base. Even at BU, we have now two or three people doing single cell seq in their own lab. So it's not anymore something that can be done only by big consortium labs. It can be done in regular labs. And the reason is because the technology is advanced and the costs are going down. So you will see more and more of single cell RNA-seq experiment in the future. And the idea is that is basically an RNA-seq, a regular RNA-seq. So if you look down there, the process is the usual one. You do a cDNA prep and then you sequence. The difference is that you do it from single cells. And so where the technology has been working on is not really in the sequencing aspect of it, but in the single cell isolation, because you have to start with a material and then separate it somehow and be able to extract RNA from single cells. And so the process where there has been a lot of development is up here in the cell isolation part. So there are different ways of doing. There are techniques that are based on FACS sorting. So you sort the cell based on extracellular membrane proteins, and then you separate them somehow in ways in which you can detect them. And so these are the other two main areas where people have developed things. You can either separate them by FACS and then put them in just in tiny wells, one cell in each well, and then go for all the preparation process. Or there are more advanced approaches where you either use fluidic platforms, like Fluidigm C1, it's one of the most common ones, or now more recently the development of drop-based approaches where single cells are isolated within single drops. And this is probably now one of the most used and most advanced one. It's called DropSeq. So just we'll go quickly through these different approaches. But keep in mind that the limitation for RNA-seq are in the way in which you handle single cells, not really the way in which you sequence them, because once you get the RNA and the cDNA produced, it's a regular sequencing experiment. The challenges are how to isolate the cells and then how to analyze the data, because you end up having data from a lot of cells, from thousands of cells, and you need to analyze them together. Okay, so in terms of option for cell isolation, there are three different approaches. The first one, as we said, are well-based approaches where cells are physically put into single wells. And so this is the most laborious approach. It was the one that was used at the beginning, so the 2009 paper, the first single cell based paper, was using something like this, where you can separately isolate single cells. You use optical tweezers to grab each single cell and put them in a little well. And then for each of the well, you need to extract the RNA, prepare cDNA, and so this is a very labor-intensive approach. That's why it was also that expensive. You cannot sequence thousands of cells this way. You can sequence up to a few hundred cells. and is not that much used right now. There is one advantage, though, and that since you have cells that are in isolated wells, you can take picture of them, you can image them. And so that allows to combine imaging approaches with sequencing, and then you can put the data together and evaluate the results of the transcriptome based on the imaging. After a while, people have started to develop fluidic platform, and this allows for higher throughput, because what happens is that cells are passed through those type of glass slides, where they are, by fluid, they get separated into single cell population, and the single cell are captured into areas of this microfluidic platform. And then and I think they are here. So this is it's an example, it's a section of one of those slides. You can see that there are areas where the cells are trapped as they flow in. So they flow in from here, then they are trapped, and then within the microfluidic platform itself, there are the reagents that can do the lysis and the RT, and so then you can directly go into the sequencing. And so this allows for higher throughput. Very different than here, where you need to pick the single cells with this little tweezer, optical tweezer, and place them into little wells. Tweezer is the thing that you use to pick your eyebrow. Okay. Pinzetta. They are optical pinzette. Okay, so one limitation of the of this type of approach is that you lose a lot of material. So you start with maybe 1,000 cells and you get about 10% of those that are captured on the platform. So you sequence a certain number of cells, you can sequence as many as you want, but the problem is that you cannot use this type of approaches for rare cell types, because it's hard to capture enough of them to be able to sequence them. The latest development is droplet-based methods, and this is a pretty cool technique where each cell is encapsulated into a single drop. And the beauty of this approach is that within the drops, people are putting all the reagents that are necessary for the RT and the sequencing. And this allows for something that is very important, which is parallel sequencing, because within each drop, so this is what they look like. This is one of the paper that introduced DropSeq. It's from Steve Carroll lab at MIT. What they have developed is a system where you have the cells that are entering in this device from the side, and then the machine is loaded with beads that are already pre-coded with everything that is required for the reaction. So on the beads, in each of the beads, you end up having one cell as well as a bead, and the bead contains the reagents that are necessary for the RT, including the enzymes, as well as a unique identifying barcode that is added to the basically a primer that is used to do the RT, but the primer includes a barcode, so a specific sequence. And so instead of having to sequence each cell in a separate lane, which is why those experiments were so expensive, you can sequence all the RNA after it's been extracted from 1,000 cells all together, because then each RNA will have that specific barcode. So when you analyze the data at the end, you can go back and say, okay, this RNA was coming from cell number one, this RNA was coming from cell number two, but you don't need to sequence them separately. You can sequence them all mixed together, because each of the cell has its own barcode. And so so after the cell go in and the beads go in, what happens is that, so this is in an aqueous base, and then once they get here, what you don't see here because it's dark, I think, no, you can see it here. There is a oil-based liquid that is inserted, and so this creates an emulsion, just like when you mix oil and water, and they will separate into little, little tiny drops. And the force in this system is such that in each drop of the emulsion, you will end up having only one single cell. And so once you have isolated the cells in such a way, you end up with a mix of drops. In each drop, there is one cell and one bead. Each bead has a different barcode. So you perform within the drop, you perform the lysis and the RNA hybridization with your specific primer. And then you can break the droplets, do the cDNA synthesis, PCR amplification, sequence, just like a regular sample. The problem then is how to analyze the data. Those require specific algorithm. And in fact, if you look at the people that have done this work, there are people from the Department of Genetics at Harvard that have developed this approach, but there are a lot of computational people. Aviva Regev is a big mathematician, computational person who has been developing algorithms that allow them to study and interpret all this data, because it's a massive amount of data. The type of results that you get are very interesting. In this first paper, this is an example from their first paper, where they did single-cell seq analysis for the retina. I think it was from mouse, if I remember correctly. And what they end up finding was that, so this is the classic representation of the different cell types that are present in the retina. So there are a few cell types that have been described long time ago. There are the cone, there are the rods, and then there are some cells that connect those sensor cells to the neurons that bring the visual information to the brain, right? What they did is that they took a retina, they separate, they dissociate all the cells, they put them in their RNA, single-cell RNA-seq protocol, sequence everything, and then analyze the data. Based on this single-cell analysis, what they found is that they can identify 39 different retina populations. So many more populations than what had been identified based on morphology and function. And they did that by clustering 45,000 cell sequencing data. So they sequenced a huge number of cells. And what is interesting is that, so the reason why they say that it's 39 is because they take all these results and then they cluster them based on expression profile, right? And so then they say that population that have the same expression profile are likely to be a separate population than the others. And then the way in which they represent them here is color-coded. So as you can see, those are the rods in blue, light blue. The population of the rods is very large, and it doesn't seem to be highly separated. There may be some slight difference, but the expression profile is pretty much conserved across the rods. Whereas if you look at the green, those are the amacrine cells that have been considered always as a single population of cells. When they sequence them, they find populations that are very distinct. So based on expression profile, it looks like there are many different subtypes of amacrine cells. And then what they did is to look at what kind of resolution they get from this type of experiment. And so they just focus on the amacrine cells and they say, how many cells do I need to sequence to be able to achieve those kind of results? And so if they sequence 45,000 cells, which is their endpoint, we are really able to separate all this population. So now they put them in different colors, but they are the same one that were all green up here. So they are considering only the green one now. And they say how much it takes, how many cells do I need to sequence to be able to separate all that green ones into separate groups. And so if I sequence 45,000 cells, I'm really able to separate these into different groups. However, if I sequence 500 cells, this is not really possible. There are some separation, but they are not yet separated into cluster. And then the more you sequence with 2,000 cells, you start to get some clusters that are clearly different. And then you get more, and again you get more separated cluster, but only once you get to these kind of numbers, you are really able to appreciate the distinction in transcriptome expression between the different cell types. Okay, so I think that's all about RNA-seq approaches. Any question about those? No? Okay, so the last thing I want to do is to discuss a couple of other approaches that are still based on next-generation sequencing, and they are also used to study gene expression, but they are slightly different. So the first one is what is called the GRO-seq, and GRO-seq stands for Global Run-on Sequencing. The idea here is that if you think about the protocol for the RNA-seq, you start with RNA, you extract RNA from the cells, right? You can choose whether you use total RNA or you use poly-A RNA, but the RNA that you are measuring is the RNA that is already accumulated in the cell. You don't have any measure of what is the active transcription. You cannot measure only the RNA that has been transcribed at a certain time. You study the RNA that is stably accumulating in the cells. So what these people have been trying to do is to say, okay, we are not really interested in the whole RNA that is accumulated in the cells. We studied transcriptional regulation. This is John Liss is a lab that studied transcriptional regulation. And so we want to understand the RNA, we want to be able to study the RNA as it is produced, as it comes out of the RNA polymerase. And so in order to do that, we need to develop a different type of approach. And so what they do is that they develop this GRO-seq approach, which is based on an old assay that is called Run-on, that's been done forever. The Run-on is an assay where you extract the nuclei from a cell, and then you keep them in cold, so transcription is stopped. So you take the RNA from the cells, you treat them with cold, or sometimes with transcriptional inhibitors, but mostly with cold. And because they are in cold, RNA polymerase stops. It stops, but it stays attached where it is. All right? It's engaged in transcription in different locations in the genome. Then you take this RNA, these nuclei, you add labeled nucleotides to it, and then you let them start transcription again. So the transcription of labeled RNA happens only at the rate it was already happening in the cells. So this is an example where gene X and Z were not transcribed, whereas Y was in the process of being transcribed. When you isolate the nuclei, transcription is stalled. Then you add the nucleotide and you let transcription to proceed. So you keep making RNA from the same place where it was making it before. You don't make it from other places because RNA was not engaged. RNA polymerase was not engaged there. But this RNA is now labeled because you have added labeled oligonucleotide. And then you extract the RNA and you just probe this at that time with the original run-on experiment. You were labeling dot blots assays. So you had little microarray, homemade microarray with the different genes. You label them with this RNA and you see which is the gene that it was transcribed. This is the old style run-on. The way in which it is now done for GRO-seq is very similar. The protocol is the same. The only difference is that at this point, instead of probing a microarray, you sequence the RNA that you get from the run-on reaction. And so the reason why this is an important approach is because it allows you to measure nascent mRNA, the RNA as it is produced by RNA polymerase and not the one that is accumulated in the cells. And this is important because it allows you to study the process of transcription itself rather than a combination of transcription and mRNA stabilization. Because if you think about it, you may have a gene that is actively transcribed and it produces a lot of RNA, and another gene that is not very much transcribed, but it was transcribed 2 days before, but the RNA has been stabilized in the cells. When you measure them with a regular RNA-seq approach, you are measuring both of them. You are measuring the one that has been produced before but is stable in the cytosol, as well as the one that has been transcribed at a specific time. Okay? And so this type of approach allow them to define different classes of genes, genes that are active and let's start from the top. So this is the type of GrowSeq result that you get from genes that are active. So because the gene is active, you get transcription all across the gene. And one interesting thing is that the type of tags that you get here are not only exon. So this is a critical difference between the GrowSeq and the RNA-seq. The RNA-seq, because you perform it on RNA that is already accumulated in the cells, has also already been processed. And so you get the exon, all the discussion we had the last couple of days, you had the exon reads, you had the junction, you don't measure the introns, right? However, in this case, you are sequencing the RNA just as it gets produced. And so this means that you are sequencing everything. You are sequencing the intron and the exon, as well as starting to see splicing as it occurs. And so this is an active gene where you get reads that are all across the locus, both exon and introns. These are genes where transcription is started, but then it paused. So these are active genes in a pausing state. And the beauty about the GrowSeq is that it allows you to see this first spike of transcription here, because we'll look at this better next week. What happens when transcription pauses is that RNA-Pol2 starts, it transcribed about 20, 40 base pair, and then it stops. And so these are the tags for the first 20, 40 nucleotides. But then you don't see much being transcribed from the rest of the genome. Just a little bit. Probably this gene is transcribed, it's still active, so it transcribed a little bit, but not much. This is a fully paused gene, so this is non-active. This is a case where you do have a little bit of transcription at the start site, so you do have Pol2 that is engaged and is starting to make RNA, but then the gene is completely off, so this gene is not active. And then there are genes that are obviously off because there is no Pol2 there, so there is no transcription. However, if you do RNA-seq, maybe you do find expression of this transcript, because it's possible that this transcript was expressed 2 days ago, and then the RNA is there, you find it in the cells, but the gene is off. So if you want to study transcription, this makes a difference. Yes?
Is it possible to study exons for the comparison of the GrowSeq data with the RNA set?
Yes. So they have actually been using this to study what we said the other day, the fact that splicing can occur together with transcription in a co-transcriptional manner. So they have studied how often they start to get intron, exon-exon junction in the GrowSeq data compared to the RNA-seq data. And this is a further confirmation of what we discussed yesterday. Yeah. Okay, and so this is another, yes, I have time. So this is another example of GrowSeq data. It's an interesting experiment. So two things to look at in this figure. The first thing is the difference between these two inhibitors. So we discussed the whole idea of RNA-Pol2 pausing better next week, but to give you an idea of what kind of data you can achieve with a GrowSeq, this is a case where they wanted to discriminate between defect stops in transcription from the beginning or stopping transcription at the point of RNA-Pol2 pausing. And so they used two different drugs. Triptolide inhibits transcription itself, the initiation. flavopyridol inhibits the pulsing escape. And so with a normal RNA-seq experiment, you wouldn't be able to differentiate between these two states, whereas with the GrowSeq, they can see a different profile. And so they treat the either they don't treat the cells or they treat the cells with the two drugs for longer amount of times, and then they see what happens. And so the difference is that when you look at the active genes with no drugs, you see transcription all across the gene. And then as you add the drugs, what happens is that the gene will finish the transcription that was already started, but it will not start any more transcription. And so you see that the transcription is slowly going down. The difference is here at the very beginning, because in this case, where you have inhibited transcription from the beginning, you don't see anything left. You just get the transcription that was already started that is slowing, tapering off. Whereas in this case, you have that active transcription that is finishing, but you also have an accumulation of this peak here that suggests that the pulse 2 is stopped in the post state. And the difference between these two graphs is simply that these are just tracks from the genome browser. So this is what the data looks like for each single gene. If you look at each single gene on the genome browser, this is the type of tracks you see. So here you are stopping transcription, you don't see anything at all. Here, so this is the base, the untreated cells. There is transcription going on in both directions. You stop transcription, there is nothing left. You stop pausing escape, it's very different. You get a very strong peak of transcription because you get those 20, 40 nucleotides transcribed at the beginning. Here, instead of showing one single gene, like here, they are showing all the gene in the genome. So it's just taking all this data and integrating them together in one single slide, but the result is exactly the same. So this graph here represents the transcriptional inhibitor. So you normally have transcription going on, you add the inhibitor, you end up with a straight line across every gene. Whereas here, you add the inhibitor, you end up having a peak that is even higher than before because you still see transcription from the first few nucleotides. Okay, and this is the last thing. You find GrowSeq in papers, but you also find a lot of other names. So just so that you know what these other names are, you find things that are called ProSeq, NetSeq, StartSeq, they are all variation of the same idea. They are all attempt at measuring nascent RNA rather than stable RNA. The ProSeq, it's basically the same thing than a GrowSeq. It's just that it's the same lab that developed it, and it adapted the protocol so that in order to have a better resolution. So the ProSeq, it's precision run-on sequencing rather than global run-on sequencing. And the idea is that it has a single base pair resolution. And so this really allows you to look at single nucleotides. NetSeq is a different protocol simply because it has been elaborated by a different lab. So this has been worked out by these two different labs. Same approach. The difference, it's a little bit an easier protocol in a way, because instead of having to do the run-on reaction, you simply isolate RNA-Pol2 with the engaged RNA. So the idea is that it's not, in a way, it's a more simple approach. You use the same idea that we discussed yesterday. When you isolate the RNA, you can select it in some way. You can select only the RNA that has a Pol2, that has a poly A, or you can select only the RNA that has a cap. In this case, they isolate only the RNA that is associated with Pol2. So they do first the chip with Pol2, and then they separate the RNA that is associated with it. And so it's an easier protocol. So that's what they do. They isolate the chromatin, and then they purify the RNA that is associated with Pol2, so only the one that is right here working gets isolated, and then they sequence it. And so that's what they called native elongating transcript sequencing. Start-seq is a variation of NetSeq, same lab, same people. Karen Aldman was in Joe Westman lab. What she did is to add a step to it so that not only you isolate the RNA that is associated with the POL2, but you also isolate the RNA that is capped. And so this allows you to exactly define the transcriptional start site because you identify the RNA as it is starting. And for the thing that she was doing, that adds some information. So, and I will see some of that work next week. So it's good to know what these techniques are because we'll look at them as we study transcriptional regulation. And so this is just an example of results from NetSeq experiments. The one interesting thing about this approach is that because you are isolating the RNA as it is attached to POL2, you can separate, you can also isolate only the RNA that is associated with specific forms of POL2. And so next week we'll study how RNA POL2 gets modified during transcription. There are two main sites of phosphorylation on POL2. I think you probably studied at some point before. There is serine 2 and serine 5 phosphorylation. So what they did in this study, they isolated either the regular POL2 or the POL2 that is phosphorylated on serine T or the one that is phosphorylated on serine 5. And then they sequenced the RNA as it is found associated with these three forms. And these allow them to do exactly what you were asking before. They allow them to look at splicing as it happens while RNA POL2 proceeds along the gene. And I think with this, we're done. So happy Easter, and see you in a week and a half. Okay. In the meanwhile, if you have, so we, transcriptomic part is done. This module is finished. I will open an activity on the website. Hopefully I have figured out how to do that. But also, if you have time to look at these things and you find out there are things you are not clear with, I'm happy the first lesson on Monday to discuss anything you would like, either about the research paper or the material that we have discussed in class. If not, we'll move forward with transcription. Il lunedì sì, al 9. Sì, 9. Alle 9 del mattino.
Quando avremo il prossimo?
No, non avete lezione. Perché De Bortoli mi ha detto che molti di voi non c'eravate e quindi non voleva che io facessi lezioni. Io l'avrei fatta molto volentieri perché ero qua. Siete in vacanza, infatti io pensavo di fare lezione il 4 e il 5 e invece lui mi ha detto che c'era pochissima gente e che quindi era meglio se non la facevamo.
Il 4 e il 5 abbiamo anche lezione.
Mi spiace perché io l'avrei fatta avanti volentieri, avrei preferito fare
mercoledì. Sentiamo anche gli altri.
Sì, io credo che a un certo punto vi abbia fatto, ma quello che lui mi aveva detto è che avrebbe fatto un poll di quanti di voi c'erano.
Sono ancora prima di iniziare le lezioni.
Esatto. Quello che mi ha detto è che il risultato di questo poll era che c'erano parecchie persone che non ci sarebbero state quella settimana e che quindi era meglio.
Magari bisogna fare lezioni di qualcosa.
Non so, ma non lo sapevo, ma dobbiamo tornare nel caso.
So, io sono sicura che questo corso non c'è lezione, perché dovrei farla io e non ci sono.
Vediamo, allora aspetta, vediamo con gli altri. Chiediamo subito a Serva, che sono c'è la prossima.
Ma che stai?
Beh, che dietro, vediamo. Ok, c'è. Cioè. Noi pensavamo che non essendoci lei ci fosse
delle volte. No, il motivo per cui non ci sono io è perché da questo post sembrava che ci sarebbero state poche persone. Che infatti è il motivo per cui le cose sono state un po' compattate, perché io inizialmente avevo pensato sto 3 settimane, ci sono quei 2 o 3 giorni per Pasqua, però poi faccio lezione, quindi quando poi mi è saltato il... non avevo realizzato che le vacanze di Pasqua erano
io ho 3 domande.
Ok.
Allora, la prima, non è limitante la quantità di una sola di RNA di una sola cellula per il sequenziamento?
No, sembra che ci riescano. Io avrei pensato, però i risultati sembrano essere significativi.
Poi seconda, sono alcune proteine codificate da.
Perfetto, fammi dire tutto una cosa. Però è una cosa che secondo me non è ancora stata analizzata a sufficienza è quanto riescano a vedere proteine che che sono espressi a basso livello. Quello non è, insomma, non è stato fatto accuratamente.
Ok, e poi ci sono proteine codificate da un trascritto antisenso?
Sì, non so se ci sono. In generale le proteine sono dei trascritti, vengono in tutte e due le direzioni.
Ok.
Anzi, ci sono un sacco di casi in cui tu hai un unico promotore che dirige la trascrizione in due direzioni diverse, un gene da una parte e un gene dall'altro. Si chiama bidirectional transcription, bidirectional promoters. E aiuta perché tu hai gli stessi fattori trascrizionali che dirigono in entrambi i sensi. Se ci sono dei casi in cui all'interno di un trascritto ce n'è un altro coding nell'altra direzione, questo non lo so.
E poi ultima, gli RNA non codificanti lunghi e corti hanno il cap e il polià quando sono processati?
Per corti? I non coding?
In generale i non coding.
I non coding non hanno il polià.
Ah, ok. Però non c'è. Perché no. Prima parlava di una cage e mi era sembrato di capire, non erano coding.
No, ce l'hanno il cap, sono una cavolata, ce l'hanno.
Ah, ok.
Ce l'hanno, sì.
Quindi non solo gli mRNA, ma...
No, ce l'hanno. Lo stack di tutti viene modificato, viene studiato.
Ok, quando... ok. Tutti quelli che escono dal nucleo, in poche parole.
Sì, esatto.
Ok, grazie.
Prego.